Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jennifer Yeremeyeva. For devotees of Russian architecture, my guest today needs little introduction. Professor William Kraft Brumfield is the leading foreign expert in Russian architecture and the author of numerous books on the subject, including his latest, Journeys Through the Russian Empire, The Photographic Legacy of Sergei Prokudin-Gorsky, published by Duke University Press in 2020, and the subject of our discussion today. Professor Brumfield currently teaches at the Department of Germanic and Slavic Languages at Tulane and has garnered more academic awards and distinctions than we have time here to enumerate, but I will just mention one. In 2019, Professor Brumfield was awarded the Order of Friendship by President Vladimir Putin, the highest honor that can be conferred on a foreigner. I have really been looking forward to our discussion about his work and about journeys through the Russian Empire. And I'm delighted that it brings Professor Brumfield to the podcast today. Professor Brumfield, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I think it's fair to say that yours is a somewhat unusual academic career. You've managed to fuse a very successful profession of teaching Slavic languages and Russian studies with a lifelong passion for Russian architecture, and the latter has involved a great deal of fieldwork. I would love us to begin by you taking us through your academic career and give us a kind of a sense of how you divide your time today. We started off, Mike, you said you'd already been in touch with Russia for much of the morning. So give us a little snapshot of your career, if you would.
Well, it's all very strange. There's a certain logic and there's a path and the study of Russian language and literature and history is absolutely essential. There's no question about that. And that was a clear direction. It wasn't easy, but my high school preparation in Latin prepared me for the trauma of knowing that Russian has six cases in the nouns, for example. So it was just the love for the literature that really started it. The camera, that's more difficult to unravel. I just was taking a few desultory photographs, but being in New Orleans, I think, as an undergraduate at Tulane University, I fell in love with the city, absolutely fell in love with New Orleans. That is so deeply a part of who I am. And not in the typical way that you might think. I don't know when I was last in the French Quarter, probably at least a year ago. That's not the point. It's the aura of the city. And I would sometimes take a camera and go down and pick times when there would be no traffic. And suddenly, you began to relate to the buildings. Buildings relate to history, and you can interpret that. And it gave me a sense of a meaningful encounter. And I got pleasure out of it. I liked the way things line up in the lens. But then going over to Russia, my first summer of 1970, that too was something of an accident. I went to the Consumer Review magazine, said, well, what's a good camera to take along? It won't be too much of a problem. Made a very good choice, Leica Konica C35. And didn't think really much about it. I took some photographs and bought a lot of Soviet slides for my future courses. and they all turned purple within 6 months.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Right. But the Kodachrome, the images that I took, and there were only, I think, 3 rolls, some of them are still being published today. How long is that? 50 years ago. Kodachrome is just a remarkable medium. And it's no one really thinks much about it anymore. But that was the basis of it. Just something that clicked in more ways than one.
No pun intended.
Right. It's just things lined up. You had a center. The eye told you what to do with the equipment. So that's the magic began there. And there was just no doubt that this was something that had to be pursued, brought into my work as a Slavist. But how to do that, it took many more years. Being at an assistant professor at Harvard, I managed to publish a cover story on Harvard Magazine. In other words, there were people outside of the academic structure who recognized the gift and recognized my impulse. Then I got a contract with David Godin in Boston on the basis of that that first article in Harvard Magazine. Totally unexpected. I have a rejection letter, and yet they called me back. David Godin, that magnificent press that was active in the 70s, particularly in the early 80s. We thought we would do a book for the Moscow Olympics. Moscow Olympics in 1980 happened without American participation. They said, okay. Well, we'll just do a book on Russian architecture. There are so many twists and turns in this entire story, so many improbable outcomes. And yet that first book, Gold and Azure, which appeared all of 1983, laid the basis for my subsequent work, including another 40 books, many of them published in Russia. But the camera was essential to all of them. Without the camera, without the vision, and you know how literally I take that term, vision of Russian culture, of Russian heritage, of Russian history, the camera was, I wouldn't have done it without the camera. It was very, very unpredictable, and I feel blessed that these things came together and sustained over so many years since.
Well, I think the blessing has been for those of us who studied Russian architecture, because your books really bring the subject to life in a very accessible way that some of the Russian publications don't manage to do for Western readership, I think.
Yeah. Well, I should say, of course, I'm enormously indebted to Russian colleagues who from the very beginning, of course, having that cover article in St. Petersburg and Harvard Magazine helped, but they say, "This he may be crazy, but let's give him a pass." And so that I was able to enter into the scholarly world of Russian architectural historians at the very top level. It's hard for me to explain. I think perhaps a certain amount of craziness helps. If this guy is so out there, then let's help. Let's give him shelter. And I have to give enormous credit to Russian colleagues for taking me under their care from those. I could give you so many stories there. And I don't know even where to begin. But I'll tell you one story in the summer of 1970, my first trip over there. We were there as language teachers at the Moscow State University. And there was a wonderful teacher there, Nina Balodina. They were just absolutely the best. They made us feel at home. Remember, this is right in the middle of the Vietnam War. We just bombed the port at Haiphong. The Russian sailors had been killed. This was a very intense time. I was from Berkeley. Saw that from another perspective. But anyway, they were so good and friendly, and they just really put us through the drills. You know those Russian language drills. intonation and all of the rest of it. And then there was one, Nina would also type up a list of, she would say, well, I'm going to take a walking tour in Moscow. And she'd type up little copies of list of churches. Remember the church, most of the churches were closed. And I said, meet at a certain time on a Saturday or Sunday. And sometimes I'd be the only person to show up.
Oh, really? Wow.
But we would still go. It didn't matter to a real teacher. It's that contact with a person who's interested. And if it's one person, fine. If it's 10, they'll still do their best. I owed a tremendous debt to her for those first excursions with my little camera going around the Church of the Trinity in Nikitniki, which I'm sure you know there in Kitai-Gorod, all of those places that just, and she was there as a guide. It's so important to have a guide to a physical, and then you start exploring on your own. So that's one example from the very beginning. Without people like that, without Russian colleagues who always met my interest, I don't think my project would have taken productive path that it took.
And that collaboration continues to today. You're still very involved with Russia, and you spend a lot of time there, I think.
Yes, right. As much time as I can. The fact that I haven't been able to do it the past year has had a side benefit. And I've been able to catalog the backlog of images, thousands of images, for my collection at the National Gallery of Art. That is another remarkable story, the way the National Gallery brought me into their enormous museum. That too is quite unexpected. We can perhaps talk about that a bit later. But all of this that I do in Russia, all of the photographs I take, have a structure that will preserve them. That too is, you can be inspired by something, but how do you share that? I think you started our broadcast with that notion of sharing. The National Gallery has enabled that to really, go forward into the generations after I'm no longer here. That sharing will continue.
That's marvelous. And as will your latest book, Journeys Through the Russian Empire, in which you juxtapose your own photographs with the photographs of someone who lived about a century ago, the pioneering photographer, Sergei Prigozhin-Gorsky.
Yes.
And let's begin our discussion of the book. For our listeners who don't know Prigozhin-Gorsky, could you sort of sketch his bio? In many ways, he's like yourself. His journey takes a lot of twists and turns.
That's right. He was born into a family of gentry in central Russia, Vladimir province, in 1863. Developed a fascination, had a good education, technical education, developed a fascination with chemistry and optics, was very soon conversant with the advances in that field in Germany at that time. Many people were trying to devise a way to break the color spectrum into usable segments that could be printed. In other words, color photography.
Mm-hmm.
And photography itself really is less than a century old at that point, so dated to the 1820s. And so here at the beginning of the 20th century, there were various competing methods for rendering an image through a machine in color. And Prigozhin-Gorsky finally chose his method. And so not only did he perfect it, but he also decided, this is a project. I am going to record Russian Empire and all its diversity, and bring back these images to the capitals, Moscow and St. Petersburg, show them to a public. So he didn't photograph Moscow and Petersburg, with very rare exceptions. He photographed the expanse of the Russian Empire, and he believed in that empire. He believed that Russia had a destiny that would take it into Eurasia. We might come back to that, because that proved to be, of course, a very complicated question. But so what? It launched him. It launched him. And it took him to Central Asia, the great monuments of Samarkand and Bukhara, for example. How did he get there? Because the Russians had taken this as part of the great game of imperial expansion. The British were in India, the Russians were in Central Asia, what we know as the Great Game. So they were there primarily for cotton. This would rich agricultural land of irrigated produce cotton for Russian textile factories. They were building railroads, pushing through. In other words, your classical colonial enterprise. But it was empire. And Perkutin Gorsky followed that empire. He only got as far as Western Siberia, but he did go into Central Asia, as well as many parts in the central and other Western areas of the empire, including areas that are now in Poland. So that for him, photography was a way to grasp a public's attention and say, this is where you live. This is the country in which you have a part. You may live very remotely in St. Petersburg and thousands of versts away. A verst is about a kilometer. You have this other part. It's all the same country. You see, photography was to be a unifying enterprise in his project. That was his vision. You bring this back to people and show them the treasures of their country, of their cultural legacy. And how his collection survived, particularly after he left the country following the murder of Nicholas II and his family, and how he was reunited with that that collection, you couldn't think this up. You couldn't make it up. It's just true, improbable. And the fact that he died, by the way, in September of 1944 after the liberation of Paris. And then in 1948, Americans were sort of combing Europe at that time, trying to restore art to its rightful owners, but also looking for treasures that they could pick up for our own powerhouse of knowledge, the Library of Congress. Someone at the Library of Congress bought Perkutin Gorsky's collection. How did he find out about it? There are various details here that are still rather murky. But it ended up in the Library of Congress, of all places.
Of all places.
And they asked me to get involved in it. So that, but the point is, I had already photographed in the 15 or so years before I found out about Perkutin Gorsky. I mean, the same places he did. He and I followed, as you pointed out, a similar logic. We wanted to record heritage and history through photographs.
Right. And could we just backtrack a minute? Because I want, for some of our listeners who aren't as technologically focused, talk to me a little bit more about the color technology and the resulting photographs, which are really mesmerizing. Particularly, your book is, by the way, for listeners, absolutely beautiful. It's a stunning, I don't even want to call it a coffee table book because it's just so, it's a gorgeous album of these wonderful photographs by Perkutin Gorsky and yourself. And sometimes I have trouble deciding which is which when I'm turning the pages because the color is really vibrant. How did he achieve that? And if you could also talk a little bit about how he was able to travel so far into the regions of the empire, because that in the turn of the century wasn't such an easy prospect, I don't think.
Yes, well, it depends. This is a paradox. He's using advanced technology to record traditional culture, and he's getting there through advances in transportation, railroad construction. Railroad construction. Some of his were river trips because his patron was the Ministry of Transportation. But ultimately, all of this was blessed by Nicholas II. He had a meeting with Nicholas in 1909 and showed the photographs. Nicholas himself was an enthusiastic amateur photographer, so that he had protection at the highest level, and he had letters allowing him access. And he had the means. In many of these trips, he had his own rail car for the laboratory, which was needed to develop those rather cumbersome glass negatives. Now, about his method, it involved the variation of a camera devised by a German inventor, Adolf Miethe, and it involved taking three separate exposures of the same object. In other words, the glass plate, which would be chemically treated, was dropped down in a box camera. It fell down, sort of a gravity feed, three times. And each time it passed in front of the lens, each drop, right? And you had an assistant who put a different filter in front of the image at each clunk of the exposure. Clunk, 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 right? The glass negative is falling down. It's descending in that box camera. So the camera has to be on an absolutely stable surface, and it has to be pointed forward. You can't tilt it up, right? Otherwise, right. Gravity won't work. And you have the person changing the filter in front of it. It's a standard three-color process. And what you have is, as a result, are blue, or cyan, as it's called, yellow, and magenta, or red. Those are the three products that you get. The filters are usually called green, magenta. Well, we're getting into optics here. Let's forget it. So you come out with three colors. And you'll notice in the book, we decided to preserve all of Perkutin-Gorsky's image. You see the Perkutin-Gorsky photographs will have that fringe. You'll see mm-hmm. a little red sticking out and blue sticking out. Those are the three exposures in his three-part glass negative. And you combine them just in typical color printing to this day. That's how you get a color image. You combine those three different levels. Well, his camera did that and is very cumbersome. And ultimately, color photography took an entirely different route, the so-called autochrome route, in which the levels are embedded in an emulsion film. But his route gave that clarity that you talk about. It was cumbersome. It was restricted in what it could do. That's why he was always climbing up church bell towers. because that would give his lens the range that he wanted. Many of those bell towers were destroyed during the Soviet period. So we have unique views in some of these the Russian towns, such as Suzdal or Smolensk. But nonetheless, I've been able to reproduce some of them, and often did so without even knowing that Perkutin-Gorsky existed. So that's wow. the history of this whole.
And let me add to
what you've said. This is, and I stand behind this statement, Jennifer. This is the most beautiful book I have ever seen in my life. All credit to the Duke design team, particularly to Matt Tausch. They deserve unlimited praise, particularly in putting Perkutin-Gorsky's photographs on one side of these large format glossy pages and mine on the other. It's just spectacular. I open the book and there's just this explosion of joy.
That's marvelous.
I just cannot praise them enough. We often don't understand what goes into a book like this. And I have enormous respect for the technical level and proficiency and professionalism that the Duke University Press brought to this book. I'm just going to say, it is the most beautiful book I have ever seen. All right?
Well, I would concur. I received my copy and spent a good 3 days just paging through it, even before I started reading the text, which is equally wonderful. So a big plug for the book to the listeners. Anybody interested in architecture, photography, Imperial Russia, it's all there.
Or book design. Anybody interested?
Or book design. For sure. What happened to the negative? Now, the negatives are glass slides, and I'm guessing they don't turn purple original, the ones you bought in Moscow. How do they get out of Russia?
Well, they were just shipped out by the Library of Congress. That was the simple part. It was how did they get to France?
Right. Yeah,
that's where we have many, many mysteries. But getting them over to the States and in the Library of Congress, what they eventually did was made copy negatives of those glass plates. And the glass plates are in deep storage. No one uses those. It's the copy transparencies made from the glass negatives that have been used. I organized the first exhibit at the Library of Congress in 1986. It's the first time these photographs had ever been exhibited because Perkutin-Gorsky didn't print them. He arranged slideshows for hundreds of people. Yeah. St. Petersburg, for example. Even after the revolution, he was still having public slideshows and the Narodny Dom, or the People's House, in St. Petersburg, for example, the largest auditorium in the city. We arranged the first exhibit of them on paper, a photographic paper, in 1986. It was really something of a problem because since he didn't print them, we didn't have anything to go on. The people who decided we're going to print them had these negatives, right? But what's your color match? Have to have a color. And I read an article about the firm in Northern Virginia that printed them for that 80 photographs for that first exhibit that I. He said, if we got the tree bark right, everything else would fall into place.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
what are the colors supposed to be? Because all you have are these enormous glass negatives with three separations.
Right.
Calibrate. Now with computer technology, that miracle, with the Library of Congress computerized them, digitized them at the beginning of this century. But now they are available to public all over the world. You can go to the Library of Congress site and see not only the combined image, the color image, but you can also see the three color separations. It's all there on the library site.
And am I right in thinking that there has been kind of a resurgence of interest in this collection inside Russia today? My husband worked for the Russian railways, and I remember one New Year's, we got an enormous coffee table book. I have to say, not as nice as Journeys Through the Russian Empire, but quite nice, and produced as the sort of the VIP gift. And that was the first time I had heard of Bakunin Gorsky, and I became quite fascinated by him. Do you find that there's a lot of interest in his work in Russia today?
Enormous, because the Library of Congress, and this is one of those noble things that the Library of Congress does, he wasn't easy. There's a backstory here as well. The fact that they decided to digitize the Bakunin Gorsky collection, they weren't just sitting there with nothing to do. There were many competing projects. But staff at the Library of Congress managed to push this one through. Let's digitize this Bakunin Gorsky collection. There'd already been a book that came out in the mid-1970s by Robert Allshaus that had access to some of those images. And so and then my exhibit came along, and because I was a specialist in, not only in Russian history, but also in photography. So I arranged the exhibit and did the annotation, because a lot of his captions are misleading or mistaken. There are a lot of stories here that we could explore, but let's move ahead to the result. So we had this position, and then the Library of Congress had a internal discussion. Should we digitize it, and should we spend our resources doing this? And they decided, yes, the Librarian of Congress, James Billington, whose memory I deeply revere, a specialist in Russian history, gave the final go-ahead. And once it came out, once it was digitized, once it was on Library of Congress site, it was a revolution in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Here they now had accessible, freely accessible, no fee needed, high-quality resolution images taken in Russia at the beginning of the 20th century. And there were numerous projects, professional and amateurish, crowd or group-type projects that people would contribute, sites set up. It became an enormous public undertaking to assimilate these few thousand images that Bakunin Gorsky has made. It's one of the best stories to come out of Russian and American cooperation in our time. The explosion of interest and enthusiasm, taking every Bakunin Gorsky image, people coming onto sites and saying, yes, my parents, my grandparents knew this.
Oh, wow.
Or coordinating them with satellite maps. Where exactly was he standing when he took this photograph? That level of detail, that enthusiasm, it's become a national project. Thanks to the Library of Congress for making that available.
That's a fascinating story. And I think that these are some, because so much was destroyed in the revolutions of 1917 and afterwards, that there is a sense of looking into a window of history, that there's an immediacy about the photographs. You do feel that you could reach in and touch the barks of the tree, and the people that he manages to photograph are looking back at you with just an insane amount of concentration.
Yeah, because
I find them hypnotic.
Yeah. Well, they had to stay still because of the explosion, as we were saying. Sometimes the small children sometimes were impatient.
There are a few blurs. Yeah,
that's right, because they turned their head as the negative was dropping down. But that really touches on one of the most gripping points in this project. I don't focus on the people. I focus on the architecture. But people appear in those photographs. Sometimes they're there deliberately at his request. And you wonder about the fate of those people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something that I raise in my conclusion of the book, which I hope everyone will read and ponder. Because these are not just beautiful images of a past that seems to have been retrieved magically. They also pose questions about what happened to Russia. Because when a decade of his taking these photographs, Russia was plunged into the most horrifying chaos and bloodshed, not after the First World War and then the revolutions, but particularly the Civil War. And one wonders what happens. Now, as far as the architecture, yes, a lot of it was lost. What does my photograph show? A lot of it remains.
Mm-hmm.
That's also a rather startling conclusion. A lot of it did survive. But the people and the fates of those buildings, let's say, many of which, for example, the monasteries were used as prisons during the Soviet period. The monastery on the front of the book, the front jacket of the book, used as a prison, terrible prison by the NKVD during the 1930s. And that's a part of Russia's history. So these photographs should also, I would hope, stimulate us to think about what Russia went through. If his photographs and mine are bookends, what happened during the long 20th century in Russia? I think the photographs, and that's why the historical context that I give in my book is a guide to some of the twists and turns that architecture represents. What survived? What hasn't? And we have to ponder what happened to the people.
Right.
I think it's just an enormous number of very serious questions that make us ponder the history of Russia in general. It has not been an easy path, as you know.
Right. The century has been quite cruel. But one question I would like to expand on. In the beginning of the book, in the introduction, you pose an intriguing question. You ask yourself and readers if Prokudin-Gorsky had any kind of sense that he was recording something that would soon disappear. And you conclude that this is probably unlikely. But you say that there are intersecting lines that intrigue on a subjective level. And when I read that, I sort of put a sticky in it because I haven't actually highlighted anything in the book. It's too beautiful. And I wondered if you might expand on that idea because it really leapt off the page when I read it first. And I have thought a lot about it since.
Well, he was aware, of course, of the fractures in Russian society before the revolution, before the First World War. I mean, he lived in St. Petersburg. There were terrorist attacks, one of which killed his would-be patron, Stolypin. He certainly knew about this, and yet it's clear, I think all evidence suggests that as a well-educated, loyal Russian citizen, he believed in that empire. So there must have been conflicting impulses in a subconscious way. There is so much that enters the realm of the fantastic in his collection and his life story and the way that my own life intersected with it. That I don't find any of this improbable. He might have sensed that this has to be preserved. Or if, even without the revolutionary changes, technology itself, urbanization, all of these things are changing Russia. We look at something that seems to be a timeless landscape of old Russia when we see some of these churches or places such as Suzdal, Smolensk. And yet they were changing radically in Russia's economic and technological development. So there's this strange disjuncture. And different people looking at Prigozhin's work today will decide which part of it they want to see. Is it Russia we have lost? Who's we and what have we lost? But still, there's this notion, is it an exercise in nostalgia? But it can also be read as an exercise of a society and undergoing a very difficult transformation. For example, as I point out in the book, the interiors of the Dormition Cathedral in Smolensk, that superb structure that survived so many wars and occupations. And you'll see, if you look carefully at the Prigozhin-Gorsky photograph, there is a Black Hundreds banner standing next to the most sacred icon in that cathedral. Now, that's the detail that I, as a photographer and historian, picked out. You can actually see the black banner, and says, Soyuz Ruskogo Naroda. Well, Black Hundreds, for the audience that doesn't perhaps know about that episode in Russian history, were arch-reactionary proponents of the old monarchist order. Not very pleasant people, in my opinion. And yet they claimed a part of the church's attention. And these are difficult questions, and they have to be brought out. So the fractures are there. He knew about it. And at the same time, the empire was a grand project that matched the other great powers of the world. So it seemed. Now, I want to also go to the Central Asian part, Journey 7. The longest in the book, that this is the first time my Central Asian work has been published in major form. Yes, right. I'm a specialist in Russian architecture, right? I was there, again, an improbable adventure, in May of 1972.
Wow.
On a trip arranged by Leningrad State University at the end of my dissertation research there. They offered us this opportunity to go to Central Asia. All of my American friends in Leningrad were busy working in the library, finishing their last research project. I had already taken care of that, and I joined up. The only American in this small group of 10 people. And it was just, it was like the journey of a lifetime to go to Central Asia, Samarkand and Bukhara, and see all of that. How could you not have done this? Anyway, I was there and was photographing these extraordinary monuments of Islamic architecture that Prigozhin-Gorsky had seen. And I saw them pretty much in the same form that he saw them. But, Jennifer, this is the point. In 1916, during the war, the Russian army tried to draft a large part of that population, of these Uzbeks, Kazakhs, and so forth, into the army as laborers. There was an explosion of violence, a rebellion against that, that led to the deaths of tens of thousands, perhaps over 100,000.
Oh, dear.
So, Prigozhin-Gorsky, he'd been there photographing this area 4 years earlier, 5 years earlier. So that the empire had the seeds of its own dissolution. He, however, had been there, photographed some of the cotton plantations, we'll call them, the irrigation works. That was all progress, as they saw it. You're making the desert bloom, right? But beneath that, there are these explosive ethnic expectations and conflicts that would tear the region apart. The Soviet Union came in and later reintegrated these areas. And now they're all independent countries, as you know. There are so many questions behind Prigozhin-Gorsky's photographs. They would require separate books. But I just want you to know that there is a tragic a sense hanging over all of his work. I think we have to be cognizant of that. What happened to the people and the places that he photographed? They're not just there to be enjoyed as an exercise in nostalgia. Mm-hmm. I would suggest that we need to think about the saga that Russia went through in the 20th century and the miracle that these photographs exist, that they even survive.
And is that part of what drives you to preserve your own photographs?
Absolutely. And I think what I do, I've been fortunate from the very beginning, before I had any idea of where this would lead, Jennifer, of keeping a log, a daily log.
Wow.
When I'm in Russia, that allows me to date all of these tens of thousands of photographs in my collection. And that means they're documents from a historical point of view. You know, mm-hmm, that they were made. A photograph, as I tell my students, is a time machine. It can take us back, but it can also stimulate our thoughts what happened after the photograph was taken. So you see that sliding along a temporal scale, the photograph allows you, if you know when it was taken. This is how it looked at a certain moment in time. Time and space come together in a photographic image if it's properly documented. So the National Gallery of Art has provided a structure in which what I know can be conveyed to generation hence. This photograph, this cathedral looked this way on January the 13th, 1998, for example. This is where it was. And because many of these buildings change in their appearance, they change since Pokrovskoy's time. Architectural historians will recognize these details. So having this notion of fixing something in time and space is essential to his project and to mine.
Right. This, I'm mind reeling here, and I think our listeners are probably thinking rather guiltily about their own maybe messier photo archives. So it's a lesson. You're providing a PSA to everybody to get your photographs in order. But let me ask you, Prokudin-Gorsky's time traveling across the Russian Empire is basically encompasses 7 years from 1909 to about 1915, 1916.
Well, actually, yeah. let me make a small emendation there. He actually began in 1903.
Oh, okay.
The audience with Nicholas occurred in 1909, but he was already traveling extensively before 1909. And you had to have something to show. You had to have something to show the Tsar.
And didn't he go out and photograph the Russo-Japanese War or the
No. What he did, there was some confusion about that. But in fact, and I've seen that book, he was responsible for producing a large illustrated book on the Russo-Japanese War. He didn't go there. There's a copy of this book. It's an enormous book in the Library of Congress. The photographs are very uninteresting. They're in black and white. Often they'll show fields littered with what turn out to be corpses. A very, very gruesome book. He was just responsible for producing the book. Because, he had to make a living. He wasn't just there taking photographs. He also had a printing, publishing, a commercial firm. They printed guidebooks, for example. Anything with illustrations in it. So that's the story of that book on the Russo-Japanese War.
I see. But what I wanted to get into was the fact that, okay, he's operating, let's say, 20 years. Your own time has been, you're almost at 5 decades now. We talked earlier about whether Prokudin-Gorsky understood that the empire was about to collapse. You started doing this in the 70s, and I wonder if you had then any sense that the Soviet Union might be about to collapse, or if you thought it was as permanent as anything else?
Yeah, I certainly had no premonition of the collapse. And I was just fascinated by all of it. I went to the Baltic countries first time, also in the beginning of 1972. Any trip that was arranged, I took. Because I've just always been interested in this intersection of a place, of landscape, and history. It says so much, and the camera gave me a way to retain that. By the way, I never take a camera when I go to places like France or Germany or England. Photography is boring work. It's hard.
It is hard, yes.
If you don't need to do it, and of course there are millions of photographs of the cathedrals in Western Europe, but in Russia and the Soviet Union, in other words, the empire, I felt that it was all interesting, and it was so different. Tallinn, Estonia, mm-hmm. and Samarkand, and Uzbekistan. I couldn't get enough of it. So I guess that's the short answer to your question. If it was there in the territory of the Soviet Union, I could always justify it by saying, this is a part of history that I am studying. But to be frank with you, I just loved it. I just liked it. Mm-hmm. I just liked going and seeing these places.
Well, your book has a structure that I think is influenced by your travels, because it's kind of a logarithmic spiral, like a Nautilus shell. You begin at the sort of historic heartland, and then in ever expanding circles, you work outwards to the Central Asia. But in the middle, we have the Urals and Siberia, the Volga River lands, and then there's the very moving photographs of the Solovetsky Islands. And would you spend a little bit of time, Professor Brumfield, just talking about each of those trips that you took and what you think is the essence of those places?
Yeah, well, the 8 journeys that make up the book are composites, and we have maps mm-hmm. at the beginning of each one, so you can see there. In other words, there's several journeys that I took, and in some cases, including Gorski took, in order to create that journey within the book. So what we're doing is we're splicing trips together that make it accessible to the reader in geographical terms, so that we're not pushing and pulling the reader all over this vast Eurasian space. We're concentrating on particular regions. And within that, you have his, Krutengorsky's trips and my trips coming together as a comprehensible entity. It's the final trip that he took. Went up to the Russian North, Solovetsky Islands, in 1960, in the midst of this horrible war. The Russians were building a railroad up to Murmansk. There was no railroad up there. It was just a forest, what is now Karelia. And going up there to take Allied war material, which was desperately needed on the Eastern Front. The Allies wanted to keep Russia in the war. The war had not gone well for Russia. Not that it had gone much better on the Western Front, but the Russians were reeling. They were being pushed back. And the Allies, particularly the British, were putting war material on up there, the closest place they could get to, which was a new town called Murmansk. And then you had to get it down to the front, to the center of the country. So they were building a railroad there. He was there to photograph the construction of that railroad. And as a side trip, he took the boat over to the Solovetsky Islands. Again, you have this moment in time that he fixed, going around the walls of this enormous structure, one of the most remarkable in Russia. And within 5 years, Jennifer, half a decade, it would be turned into the center of a budding concentration camp empire, about which Solzhenitsyn wrote about. Archipelago Gula. 5 years. Krutengorsky is there photographing. 5 years later, it becomes a prison camp that would be the prototype for Gulag, the state camp system. You just sort of shudder when you think about it.
Yes. Yes, it's very harrowing.
Yeah. And then I'm there again, just as these buildings are being cleaned and refurbished. I was there at the perfect time, 1998, 1999, when most of the scaffolding had come down. Some of it has since gone back up. But I was, it was just, and to be there that far north in the summer, and I was there in late June on both 1988, the quality of the light, particularly in, around 11 o'clock in the evening, before mid, this something that is. The only thing that brings you back to reality, you know what brings you back to reality? The humming of mosquitoes.
That's true.
You cannot. You've got to have a defense against them, or they literally will drive you insane.
Insane. That's true. The all the Volga River cruises that I've been on, that has been the that has been the real scourge of trying to enjoy yourself in that part of the world.
Oh, Jennifer, that's nothing. That's nothing.
That's nothing. Okay.
You have to be in a swarm in the north of Russia or Finland, for that matter. It's people learn how to cope.
It's dreadful.
It's terrible, yeah.
You've gone through a lot to get these photographs, and as I was reading your book, I was intrigued by the juxtaposition. Here you have Prokudin Gorsky, who has this imperial patron, Nicholas II, who's a passionate shutterbug himself, and who gives him the laissez-passer. He can go anywhere in the empire, and also he's given a sort of blanket precaz or order that every civil servant must render aid if Prokudin Gorsky needs it. And the Ministry of Transport is putting all these things at his disposal, customized Pullman cars, river ships. Did you ever feel a little jealous of Prokudin Gorsky's setup?
No, not really. It was a customized rail car, not Pullman car, but rail car.
That's right, rail car.
It's a slight difference. But his and he often had his at least one his assistants with him, including one of his sons. So it's something like a family venture as well. It's really lovely to see the way Prokudin Gorsky arranged his life to accommodate these travels. But as for feeling envious, no. had so many. I can't tell you how much I owe the drivers of Russia. I never drive.
Said no one ever except Professor Brownfield.
right. They have just worked miracles getting me over the terrain, and ultimately see. Now, unlike Prokudin Gorsky, I didn't have to follow the rail and waterways.
Right.
I really went out into the deep territory, and there you need four-wheel vehicles. You need Russian experience. And the more extreme the conditions, the more fascinating the visual material in so many cases.
Sometimes that's certainly true.
The winter cold. You know, just very few of his photographs, in fact, I don't think any in the book, are taken in the winter.
Mm.
And because it was technically, it just was very difficult for that box camera to operate in anything other than normal temperate conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I found the winter sometimes gives the most fascinating results. To take a photograph of a medieval cathedral in the swirling snow, I mean, what could be more fascinating than that? And so that I've just been enormously grateful to the people who, again, have maybe seen that insane look in my eyes and said, "All right, we'll take him there," and. It's particularly in the Russian north, but not only. Mm. The Urals, all of these other places. There are photographs you see in that book, I think you can understand this, that are very hard to get to in many places. I'm the only American who's ever been there, particularly in some of those Urals towns, which are strictly speaking off limits. I wasn't supposed to be in some of those places. Mm-hmm. But if you have local patrons, local historians, local preservationists, they can get you through.
Well, and it sounds like you have a Rolodex that would be the envy of any adventure photographer.
Yeah, and I'm going to keep it to myself.
Good for you.
just kidding.
I wanted to ask you one question that's a bit cheeky, and so I apologize in advance. But as we record this on January 27th, Russian architecture has been in the news in the last week in the form of Putin's supposed alleged palace on the Black Sea coast. I think Alexei Navalny's explosive video is now reaching almost 100 million views on YouTube. And I think the general feeling is that this is quite a garish and horrific architectural situation, if indeed, you know, the video is to be believed. What were your thoughts when you heard about that, and how do you feel it fits into the history of Russian architecture?
Well, I've heard about this long before now. I mean, there have been rumors about this setting for at least half a dozen years. But I think what I've seen of new Russian mansions and so forth, I'm not saying anything about what the object you're speaking about, but basically the taste is terrible. I mean, it's just awful. And you compare that with what was being built at the beginning of the 20th century for Russian industrial magnates or the imperial estates on the Black Sea coast, many of which were Trudnogorsky photographed. And they're beautiful.
They are.
Particularly, for example, in Crimea, the imperial palaces, and Livadia and so forth, that Nicholas II built. They are very, very impressive as architecture. So I don't know what happened to the base, the taste so much during that period. I've seen very, very little in these garish, nouveau riche mansions to attract any sort of positive attention, which is not to say that they're not good architects there. And some of them
are. No, that's true. They're very good architects.
Yeah, and building some interesting houses. Some of them, the simpler and more natural they are, the better. But the money often spoils things. It can enable, but it can often degrade. Have I expressed that succinctly?
I think you've expressed that very succinctly, and I think that your book would be an excellent addition to any architect's library working in Russia today, because you have captured some of the more stunning aspects of Russian architecture throughout your career. And this book kind of brings it all together into one glorious journey through a Russian empire.
Yes, and I think it's perfectly suitable as a VIP gift.
Absolutely.
I have no problems with any sort of audience looking at this book, because I think we all stand to gain from it.
Well, I'd like to congratulate you on it, because it's just brings so many of the threads of your work together. There's history, there's literature, language, and just the stunning photographs, and the tale of two photographers charting the Russian Empire.
Congratulations. Well, thank you. And as we started our conversation, sharing this is so important.
Absolutely.
And, thank you. I'm very grateful to you for allowing me to share my experiences.
Well, just share a little bit more before we close, and let us know what's on the horizon for you. I'm sure you're as anxious to get back overseas as I am.
There are various projects. Some of which involve photographic documentation, places that I want to return to, frescoes I want to photograph again after 30 years. There are a couple of books in the work. But I'm also at this point in my life, and I'm 76 years old, thank God. I still feel fit and ready to go out into the field. But you know, there's an American side of my work that very few people know about. Photographs that I took in the late 70s when I was an assistant professor at Harvard. And I don't want to spend too much time talking about that now, but the Russians, God bless them, have already published some of my American photographs. It's a totally different side of my
interesting
photographer. It's not the documentary aspect that you see in my Russian work. And stay tuned for that.
Oh, fantastic. That's something to look forward to.
But then, and the Russians have picked up on this. So I think this intersection between who I am and an American and what I do in Russia intersects in sometimes very mysterious and unexpected ways. It's not just about prepping me to go to Russia and pursue this grand dream, this project. Mm-hmm. Who I am as an American is also a part of what I do in Russia, and I look forward to bringing that to the public and exploring it. So that's something else that maybe we can talk about on another occasion.
Well, I hope you will come back and talk with us about it. And where can people find out more about your work? Journeys Through the Russian Empire is available wherever great books are sold. And where can our listeners learn more about you?
I think there's a good Wikipedia article, a Russian version. There's an English version. And that has some of the basic information. Links to the books and the Amazon site. People will find out. But I would say that the Wikipedia article is a good place to start.
Well, I would agree, and I will stick that in the show notes. That's about all we have time for today. But Professor Brumfield, it has been a real pleasure and honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
And thank you for joining us on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jennifer Yeremeyeva, and I will be back soon to discuss another new book with its author. Until then, thank you so much for listening.